morning, a question facing governments around the world: should they negotiate with terrorists in order to rescue trapped citizens, or try to end hostilities or strike some sort of deal? The public answer is no, we never do. We'll hear a passionate rebuttal of this from someone who's studied the history, who's helped do deals with men of violence. Jonathan Powell says governments who do manage to converse usually achieve results that are worth it. But is the current crop of terrorists beyond any hope of reasonable talks? Plus, the way we're educating our engineers, are we preparing them for the vital people work required, or more the technical science of their brief? And the chef who helped us love what the Middle East can offer our senses. Yes, that's Greg Maloof, the Melbourne boy of Lebanese background, who's now one of the world's celebrity chefs. He adores the food and rituals of his heritage, Middle Eastern heritage, though he had to rediscover that and then decide to hand it on big time. So around about 20 to 9 today, he'll tell us why. The critique of engineering education from within the world of engineering, which has held a major conference in Melbourne this past week. That's around 20 past eight. Jonathan Powell, who was Tony Blair's chief of staff, among other things, watched closely as authorities talked to the men of violence in Northern Ireland and struck deals. He believes it's almost always possible and should be tried, even with something like the Daesh group or ISIS. Well, is he right? And later this half hour, the big court case is underway that you might have missed, which will define what is unconscionable conduct in business. And of course, all this is coming after quite a week in the life of the ABC and Australia. We prefer to be reporting on the headlines rather than in the headlines in the ABC, but that appears to be where we've been, and some of the commentaries I think have been particularly tough, especially when they come by people who've penned them after having been within the ABC and who seem to have axes to grind. Hardly honourable, I would have thought. And, of course, Phil Hughes' death just reminds us how much we do share. Your thoughts do go out to that family. It's hard enough to have death, but sudden death like that is really exceptionally difficult, so our thoughts all go to them. But first today, at the end of what seems like a pretty busy year all round, to the story that's likely to dominate and really could be a game changer around the way Australia does finance on a macro and micro level. Because the officially named Financial Systems Inquiry, chaired by David Murray, the Commonwealth's former CEO, is due to release its final report this coming week, amidst a general view that some of its key findings will relate to Australia's superannuation system and whether it really is fit for purpose, namely to help Australians to plan safely for a comfortable, assured retirement, preferably living beyond the pension. Now, there are great expectations around this report's release, and some hints of his attitude during this past week from the very independently minded ex-banker. Mr. Murray, for instance, said that regulation can do only so much to rebuild trust within the banking industry and that aggressive sales cultures within banks must change. Now, in a preemptive move, very interesting one, Australian Super indicated just a couple of days ago that it is lowering its membership fees. The question is, will others follow? Is this about to become the new debate we have to have? So change is afoot, and to talk about it, I'm joined once again by Sam Wiley, Associate Professor at the University of Melbourne and a Fellow of the Melbourne Business School, who's joining us very early from Perth, and Ian Verinder, the ABC's Business Editor. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Morning, Geraldine.
Ian Verinder, this crackdown on fees in the superannuation industry, which clearly Australian Super thinks it's going to get ahead of, how far do you think the final report is likely to go?
Look, David Murray, when he was first appointed to head this inquiry, there were a lot of concerns that as the former head of the Commonwealth Bank, he would not do a really investigative look at what's going on, that it was all going to be a bit of a whitewash and that he was heavily conflicted. But what's emerged from the interim report and his comments since has really shaken the banks up. He has taken a very independent view, and he seems to really be focusing on the hard issues, which are on the macro level, that the banks need to have a lot more capital behind them to ensure that taxpayers don't get slugged in the event of another financial crisis. And on the superannuation front that fees are just way out of control. And, you know, whenever you get a fight over money and over fees, the truth tends to get lost in the ether. But one salient fact in all this, our superannuation pool is around about $1.6, $1.7 trillion, so it's very, very large. And the fees that flowed out of that last year alone amounted to $21.6 billion. Mm. That's just an extraordinary amount of money, and that's why you've got such a heated debate over financial advice, you know, all this stuff that was going through the Senate in the last week or two, and the Murray Inquiry as well.
Yes, I think it was the Grattan Institute, on whose board I sit now. I think they did that big report this year, which I think really did amount to a significantly affected the agenda. I think they worked out that something like about $2,000 a year was averaged out as everybody paid for someone else to manage their retirement money.
That's right, yeah. I think the other figure that's quite handy to know is that about a quarter of all the benefits that you gain from your superannuation in a good year flow through to fees, to various advisors, to funds managers, to stockbrokers. There's a whole, you know, layer upon layer. It's like a Sara Lee cake, really, isn't it? There's just all these fees that get gouged out all along the way. And if you compare our superannuation system that we're all in compared to the one that public servants are in that's run by the Future Fund, I mean, the Future Fund is really, I think, the model that should have been adopted way back in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, where you have a government instrumentality that appoints a couple of asset allocators, and they run the whole thing, minimal fees, and they invest for the long term rather than this short term, heavily focused on the stock market that the superannuation system that we are all in really relies upon.
Well, Sam Wiley, it is as if another whole industry, I mean, that's an extraordinary $21 billion, I think it was, isn't it? Ian said, of money that is going around the country. This move by Australian Super, Ian Silk, the chief executive, said they're already lowering fees by bringing investment management in-house. Is that the way of the future?
You know, I think that is the way of the future for the industry funds. At the moment, the industry funds don't manage very much of their members' money. They really do mostly administration. They collect the money and then they farm the money out to investment managers who do the investing. And the industry fund, on behalf of their members, pay the fees to the investment managers. But now they're going to bring that in-house. But I should say, Geraldine, that AusSuper has got pretty low fees anyway. Across the whole industry, the industry funds, such as AusSuper and HostPlus and CBUS and the like, they have got the lowest fees in the industry. So, you know, AusSuper charges, now I'm probably going to get this wrong, so I don't upset them, but they charge for their membership fees about $2.50 per week, and then they charge between 50 and 70 basis points, so that means between 0.5% and 0.7% of their members' investments per year for investing the money, compared to figures of more like 1.2 to 1.7% when investors put their money not into the industry funds but into the retail funds.
Yes, you know, it's interesting too that some people have been writing about, and I don't know whether Murray's going to go anywhere near this, but that the whole structure of our system, where we talk about lump sums guide us, and if you look at your printout when you get your estimates, it's looking at lump sums rather than focusing on what your retirement income stream could be. And people like Professor Robert Merton from the School of Management at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology wrote in the conversation in the middle of the year. He thinks there should be a whole paradigm shift in the way we think about superannuation to really make it fit what it was designed to do, which is to assist people to get off the pension and to think about retirement, how they're going to support themselves in retirement. Now, do you think, Sam Wiley, is this way beyond Murray's remit?
Oh, I think so. He's been thinking mostly about the level of the fees and the vertical integration of the industry, where the vertical integration means that the people who are sitting across the desk from investors, who investors go to see for their financial advice, those financial advisors, instead of them being independent, completely independent, most of them work for the manufacturers of investment products. In fact, most of them, most financial advisors, of the 15,000 odd financial advisors in Australia, about 70% of them work for either AMP or for one of the big four banks, ultimately. They work for groups called dealer groups that are then owned by AMP or one of the big four banks, but ultimately those advisors work for one of those big five. And so that vertical integration creates quite a lot of incentive problems. I mean, are the investors, are the financial advisors really working for their employers, or are they working for the investors who they're providing the advice for? So most of Murray's thinking has been really tied up in whether they could make the advisors more independent, separate them from those banks, you know, take away that vertical integration and make them more independent. I think, unfortunately, Geraldine, that's going to go in the too hard basket. I think that that's something that the FSI committee would like to do, but it's simply going to prove to be too difficult.
So what do you think he is going... So we sort of say he's going to do a crackdown on fees, but, I mean, Ian Verrider, do we know how?
Well, that's the difficult question, really, isn't it? Because the banks, of course, you know, dominate the superannuation industry, and it's been an enormous generator of profit for them. You know, they call it wealth management, and I think, you know, it's wealth management for the banks rather than for individuals. It's hard to know exactly what recommendations David Murray will come up with. I tend to agree that I don't think you can really make the advising business more competitive, because they are actually ultimately owned by the banks. So it's going to be a very difficult one for David Murray to tackle. But of course, on top of that, we've had these changes that were put through by the government knocked back in the Senate just in the past week, which again has adds another layer of difficulty
that's
to the whole
FOFA
question. Yeah.
Mm. But I suppose there could be some sort of extension of the whole My Super, couldn't it, system, which is for the 4 million Australians who are just in default funds, so they don't think about it. They've brought those fees right down. I mean, it's very early days for My Super, but is that something, Sam Wiley, that could be extended and you know, developed a little more along the lines that you were describing earlier?
Well, that is possible. Ian was referring to the possibility, earlier Ian was referring to the possibility that when investors don't make any decision about where they want their super to go, because we all have to pay 9.5% of our salaries into super, that's compulsory. But then if we don't say explicitly who we want to manage that money, then it goes into a default fund called My Super, and that My Super fund is determined by the employer. Now, there could be simply a utility run, there could be a government investment investor run by the Future Fund, for instance, that provided high-quality and low-cost investment services for people who don't make any decision, who aren't really paying attention or don't feel like they know enough to make a decision. And, you know, in New Zealand, there's a system very similar to this. If you don't make a specific delegation, then it doesn't go to a fund determined by your employer. It simply goes into the government-determined fund, and that's run at very low cost and with good results. So, you know, and I think that's probably what Ian was had in the back of his mind when he mentioned this, is the New Zealand system. And there is a possibility that Murray will make a recommendation along those lines, but he hasn't really signalled that very strongly up to this point.
I mean, Ian Verrider, it's so interesting when you stand back and look and try to think what is going on here in this, you know, very aggressive bank behaviour, obviously behind the scenes of late, on a couple of levels, I think we've seen coming out particularly with this government. The superannuation system, of course, when you look at it, in terms of managing the nation's money, will eventually be as large as, within not terribly long a time, possibly larger than the banks. So are we really moving towards a quite historic shift to a superannuation-driven system of our money rather than a bank-driven system in terms of how money is allocated towards investments, say, in terms of asset classes?
Look, you know, if you go back to the genesis of the entire system, Paul Keating was the one who put it together, and back then, you know, he thought that if you doled this out to the private industry, it would be much more efficiently run. And interestingly, when Peter Costello from the other side of politics decided to put public sector superannuation into work, he did it through a centralised system, so diametrically opposed both of them to their own sort of ideologies. But look, I think it's just become so big and so cumbersome and such a money pot, and with that creates vested interests that it's very, very difficult to shift. And there are arguments that are being put forward in the past year or so over all of this, which really are quite annoying if you actually know anything about it. And it just demonstrates the power of vested interests to protect that wealth, that money flow towards them.
Look, I just must ask you both, or ask you, I think probably Sam, to you, just quickly, the two other key areas, David Murray talking about the need for restoring trust, and the whole idea of much bigger amounts of holding capital to make the banks safer. Now, do you think he's going to go there when it finally comes to it?
I think that he is. So taking the second one first, Geraldine, with the bank capital, I definitely think that there's going to be a requirement for the banks to hold quite a lot more capital, a bigger buffer to absorb losses on loans without having to go to the government to bail them out. So that's going to be around between $25 and $30 billion of extra capital, and I think the banks are basically resigned to that happening. And so what was the other point?
And trust, interesting remarks about trust.
It is early in the morning.
It is for you.
Yes, absolutely. So I don't think he's going to do anything about changing the vertical integration. He's going to try to talk down fees, and he's going to, you know, I think that the main recommendation, and this will be similar to what happened in the UK when there was a big financial systems inquiry into superannuation and the wealth management system, that the main recommendations and the main outcomes were that financial advisors had to have better training and better qualifications. And I think that that's what's going to happen, is that the Murray Inquiry will insist that financial advisors are better trained, and that part of that training will be the ethics and culture of financial management. And so I think he's going to go at it that way.
Look, thank you both very much indeed, especially to you, Sam Wiley, who's up very early in Perth. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Also, and Ian Verinder, thank you to you as our business editor. And we're expecting that Big Murray report sometime this week. He's scheduled to give a big speech next Monday, and the view is that probably means the report will be out late this week. Now, coming up here on Saturday Extra, the alleged unconscionable conduct of Coles towards their suppliers. But what does this mean?
Alex Unce is one of Australia's leading architects. He designs everything from street furniture to beautiful houses to entire precincts, and he always does it by hand.
Designing and drawing is time that evaporates that I feel good. You know, I feel good doing it, and I can feel myself, I relax with it. I find it, if you like, easy to do, and I enjoy it.
Alex Unce, architect and planner, is on Sunday Profile. That's 12:30 this Sunday here on RN.
The ACCC, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, has launched new cases of unconscionable conduct against Coles supermarkets that, if successful, could change supplier relationships across all industries and businesses. But you may have missed this court case underway, given everything else that's happening. The ACCC, though, must prove that Coles acted immorally in its relationship with its suppliers, and not simply that it has gained a business advantage or superior negotiating power. The law's been around since the early 1980s, but it remains fairly open-ended, and very few cases have been successful. It's hoped that the cases against Coles will provide better guidance to the courts when making judgments about what does constitute commercial wrongdoing. Fines can be as high as $1 million per offence, but the Coles case is unlikely to be resolved quickly. Could take several years for a final outcome. Sally Scott is a partner at Hall and Wilcox Lawyers in Sydney. She's been following the case closely, and she joins me now. Good morning and welcome to Saturday Extra.
Good morning, Geraldine.
What is the current definition legally, Sally, of unconscionable conduct?
Well, that's not such an easy question to answer. There actually is no precise definition. The legislation itself simply refers to unconscionable conduct. So you have to look at case law for definitions, and of course there isn't much case law on it. Essentially what this law is about is that businesses must act in good conscience and in a commercially moral way, which of course might be an odd concept to many, that business would even be expected to act in good conscience or in a moral way. But it's a rather abstract and uncertain concept. It's more than, as you said, it's more than just unfairness. Mm. There needs to be a level of moral wrongdoing in a commercial way.
And what's a classic example which has been tested and found to be unconscionable?
Well, the law itself started with what's known as the Amadio case, and that's your classic example, which is where a bank was held to have taken unfair advantage of some elderly parents. They didn't speak English. They were asked to sign a guarantee for a son's business and they didn't know what they were signing. So that's the typical example. And it was held that they were at a special disadvantage. They couldn't speak English. They didn't understand what they were saying. And it was held to be unconscionable, immoral for the bank to insist on them or to ask them to sign this guarantee. And since that time, the law has developed so that we're now seeing law, or we're now got law that for unconscionable conduct that applies to business-to-business relationships.
Which undoubtedly, and this is clearly what the is the core of the case that the ACCC has brought against Coles, because there, and I'm just reading from Malcolm Maiden's piece, I mean, various people have tried to summarise it, but effectively the ACCC says that Coles forced suppliers to pay gaps in the profit it made and the profits it wanted to make on products like frozen food, potato chips, shower cleaner, even when it might have incurred, it might have been responsible for some of the problems faced by the smaller producer. So that if the smaller producer nominates a figure, in effect, or they and Coles nominate a figure that they imagine will be the profit, and then for a range of reasons that profit doesn't occur, Coles is saying to the smaller producer, you make up the difference. That's sort of essentially what is part of the allegation, isn't it?
Exactly. And that's part of what the law considers. The law looks at a whole range of factors, such as the relative bargaining strength. So in this situation, we've got a large company against many smaller companies that are in effectively a relatively weak position. And the law looks at whether or not the larger company is taking advantage of the positions. And one way of looking at that, the law has seen, is that the larger company imposes a condition, a term, that's not within the smaller company's control. It might be within the larger company's control. It might not be justified for the commercial interests or commercial protection of the larger company. So one aspect of the Coles case is there's an allegation that Coles has imposed late delivery fees in excess of what it expects its actual loss will be.
Yes.
So again, the law looks at, well, is it reasonably... Yes, there's no harm in imposing such fees, but the law says it needs to be... It needs to have some relation to their actual loss. And if you're dealing with companies of the same size, equal bargaining powers, then that's what you would typically find. And what this law does, it steps in and says, OK, we're not dealing with companies of equal bargaining powers necessarily. We're looking at unequal bargaining powers. So we need to, we the law and the ACCC, the regulator, needs to step in and protect the smaller business.
Yes, yeah, so I'm just going to read because I think this is quite interesting. For instance, when Coles' profit from selling oats cleaning products fell short of budget by $326,000, this is in 2011, Coles demanded that Oats pay the retailer the same amount without explaining how it came to the figure or how the profit gap had occurred. When Oats refused to pay the full amount immediately, Coles deducted a further $246,000 from a payment due to Oates without its permission. Coates which is owned by owned by GUD Holdings, eventually agreed to pay $365,000 after Coles flagged a range review, which obviously would give you a great deal of concern, because you'd think, well, all of my products are up for grabs. And the ACCC chairman says this is the most egregious of hundreds of complaints made by suppliers about the major grocery chains. So, I mean, this sort of case law is made case by case, is it?
It is, and we quite often see this in law, where you've got a very generic term in legislation that then is given meaning through years and years of case law. Now, this is an area of case law that we just don't have many cases yet, and it's a term used in legislation that is very abstract and uncertain. There is no definition in the legislation for this term. And to a certain extent, that's necessary. We need this to be open-ended to a certain extent, because the whole concept of unconscionable conduct is that it is conduct that is commercially immoral or commercially unacceptable. Now, what might be commercially unacceptable today might not be commercially unacceptable in 2 years' time. So this is an area of law that needs to develop with commercial practices and changing commercial practices. So it's necessarily open-ended, which means it's difficult for big business to work out, well, where is the line? How firm can we be? Because it's not simply a matter of, you can't criticise a larger company for simply striking a better deal or for exercising its superior negotiating power by ending up with a good deal and or a smaller company ending up with a bad deal. That happens in business every day. And if that was unlawful, we'd say every business out, or almost every business out there in court. Yeah. It's got to have that immoral element.
Well, gee whiz, you get into issues of morality and moral codes. And, you know, I suppose what also strikes me is that this could be the unacceptable face of capitalism, couldn't it? Especially if you have such concentration of power as you do in our grocery chains. So, in a way, the courts are being drawn in to the market in quite remarkable ways, aren't they?
Well, that's right. But that's the whole purpose of the regulators, the ACCC, and this whole area of the Australian consumer law. It's there to protect either the consumer or business that can't stand up for itself. That's what it's there for. And not only can businesses take action itself in the courts under this law, but the ACCC, the regulator, can as well. And that's what we see in this situation. The ACCC has stepped in and said it's going to take action against Coles. And that's quite understandable, because in many of these big business versus small business situations, particularly when you've either got a monopoly or a duopoly or similar to it, small business is not going to take action. We haven't seen small business come out and actually speak to the press in this situation.
No.
They've got a lot on the line, and it's not just in the supermarket situation. It's in many industries out there where you've got a couple of businesses one business with a lot of bargaining power, and small business that feel as though they pretty much have to agree to anything that's put to them. So that's the very purpose of this law,
and yet
step in and protect them, try and protect them.
Supposed to be the basis of our society. We've only got a minute, but I assume this will go all the way to the High Court, whatever the result.
Oh, that's my guess. It would have to, I think. It's Coles couldn't allow it to, couldn't allow any initial finding against it to stand. And the ACCC, similarly, if it lost in the first court, in the first round, it would have to appeal. It's a case that, as I said, there aren't many cases in this area. So the ACCC is going to push it all the way through to the High Court, and that could take years.
Sally Scott, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks, Geraldine.
Sally Scott, a partner at Hall and Wilcox Lawyers in Sydney, on a very, very interesting case, which we'll watch. I hope you will too. Coming up after 8, terrorism, ransoms and government. We'll talk to Jonathan Powell, who has a very strongly developed set of views. Now news time, 8 o'clock.
RN's White Paper, a free monthly digital magazine. Subscribe at our homepage.
again, lovely to have your company, Geraldine Doogue, with you. Quite a weekend in Australia's life in the aftermath of Philip Hugh's awful death. I just have in front of me something that was put around by the Mossman Cricket Club, whose Philip's brother Jason plays in their first grade side, and the president said he just had so many parents and everything coming up saying, how do they talk to their kids? And this is a lovely final paragraph, which I think is probably fitting to hear. I think it would be a fitting tribute if all Mossman junior teams chose this weekend to play their cricket as Philip played it. Cheeky, gritty, respectful, imaginative and joyous. He played his cricket as he lived his life and we loved him for it. Hug your teammates, the opposition, and give three cheers for the umpire. That is what he would want us to do. I suspect that that is right and fairly good advice. And again, as I said earlier, our thoughts very much with his family. Now, we're going to have quite a few more things to smile about, I hope, in today's last hour of the program. Greg Maloof, chef extraordinaire, who got us into Middle Eastern food, among others, a little bit later in the program. And also a very interesting critique from an engineer about the way our engineers are being trained and what they're not being trained in, which is people management. Now, governments of all countries say they'll never talk to terrorists, as we know, and yet they nearly always do. In fact, Hugh Gaitskell, the former leader of the British Labour Party mid-last century, summed it up rather well. All terrorists, at the invitation of the government, end up with drinks in the Dorchester. My next guest, a former diplomat and now author Jonathan Powell, has investigated the ins and outs of how governments negotiate with terrorists in his new book titled Talking to Terrorists, How to End Armed Conflicts. Jonathan was in Libya fairly recently representing the British Prime Minister David Cameron to try to promote dialogue between rival factions there. He served as the first Downing Street Chief of Staff under Prime Minister Tony Blair until 2007, where he was instrumental in the Northern Ireland peace talks that led to the Good Friday Agreement. And he watched this very closely indeed. He was so inspired by it that he's now set up his own charity, Intermediate, where he's now CEO, which works on ending armed conflicts. And I'm delighted that he can join me on the phone from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm just going to come back to your role in Libya as the UK official envoy, because I'm very interested in it. But this week, in fact, your government passed specific laws banning the back-channel payment of ransoms by insurance companies who actually may substitute a payment for what is really is a ransom. Now, do you approve of that or not?
Yes, I do. I totally understand why the government wants to stop ransoms being paid. At the moment, what happens is when ransoms are paid, you build up terrorist movements. You give them more and more money. Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, down in the Sahara Desert, has made more than 30 million from ransom payments. They can fund themselves by ransom payments alone. So if we carry on paying ransom like that, we'll get more and more people kidnapped and more money in the hands of the terrorists.
So, in fact, even though what we do know now, it's devastating in a way to realise this, that the countries that where ransoms have been paid have got their citizens home, and where they haven't, they've been beheaded of late. You know, it does make you think.
Yeah, absolutely. But what it makes you think is that everyone should have some solidarity on this. And the G8 meeting 2 years ago, all the governments agreed that they would follow this policy. They would not pay ransoms. Unfortunately, not all governments are following that.
Okay, so I'll come back now to your recent work in Libya, where I don't think there has been much kidnapping of late, but you can tell me if I'm wrong. But what sort of work are you specifically involved in Libya, which is, you know, gradually being recognised more and more as a failed state? It's really not getting back on its feet from what I can read.
That's right. It has it's gone badly wrong. My job is to try and help see if I can bring the sides together using the expertise I learned in Northern Ireland and elsewhere to see if I can get the parties to talk to each other. I'm sad to say there have been kidnapping there. A British kidnap victim was released only about 3 weeks ago, and there have been a number of diplomats who have been kidnapped and, of course, Libyan citizens. So I'm afraid it does happen there, and I'm afraid the violence has got worse. It's fairly limited. It's limited to Benghazi in the east and to a small pocket in the west near to Tripoli. But it is bad, it is increasing, and we still haven't got a political settlement in view yet.
So have you been involved in any of those negotiations yourself for the release of people?
No, not on hostage. We don't do hostage negotiation. My little charity, we work on political negotiations. But I've been down there in Ghadames, down in the Sahara, trying to see if we could get to a political settlement. We got the two sides together and they started work. But then it got knocked sideways by a judgment by the Supreme Court saying that the parliament was illegal. So we always have problems when we do this kind of work. But I'm actually medium-term confident that Libya can get back on its feet. It's not like Syria or Iraq. It really is a different sort of conflict.
And so let's go to what you, the key things you did find about, because I wonder whether the situation does matter and whether you can talk to terrorists, like when you say Libya can get on its feet more than, say, Syria, because it just doesn't have such a burden of blood, I suppose. And I assume there's some sort of working machinery there. Is that also the sort of thing you have to think about when you really assess whether you're likely to get good results from talking to terrorists?
Yeah, I mean, the difference between Libya and, say, Syria or Iraq is it doesn't have those ethnic divisions. You know, in Iraq, you have Kurds and you have Sunni and Shia religious divisions. Libya is very uniform. Everyone is the same ethnicity, broadly speaking. Everyone is the same religion. So life is easier there. But actually, there are two big conditions that seem to make a difference to getting to success in a civil war. The first is getting to what we call a mutually hurting stalemate. That means both sides realize they can't win militarily. They try fighting and they find they get stuck. And it's when that appears that people seem willing to make some progress. The other thing that seems to make a big difference is political leadership on both sides. In Northern Ireland, we were lucky. We had really good leaders locally in Northern Ireland itself, but also good political leaders in Bertie Ahern in Ireland and Tony Blair here in the UK, my former boss. In his autobiography, he says that I accused him of having a messiah complex, but actually it was Mo Molam, our very colourful Northern Ireland secretary, yes, who said he thought he was effing Jesus, which is a slightly different thing, but comes to the same thing in the end.
What did you learn out of the Northern Ireland situation? It's clearly made a profound influence on you, judging by your book. What were the key lessons that you've taken into your current work?
Well, it did make a profound impression on me. For 10 years, when I was in Downing Street, being the chief of staff, I used to fly across the Irish Sea more or less once a week to go and meet Adams and McGuinness in safe houses, talk to Trimble, talk to Ian Paisley to try and get to peace. And I have to say, it was a very, very painful process. It was often extremely depressing. And many people thought the Northern Ireland was insoluble. But in the end, we managed to get to a solution. And I think what I learned above all else is that if you have patience, if you have determination, you can get to a settlement in almost any of these conflicts. But a strange thing happens when you're dealing with it. Everyone says, oh, it's insoluble. You're never going to find a solution to Northern Ireland. When you have, everyone says it's inevitable. It was always going to be solved. It was solved because of the economic situation. It was solved because of 9/11. But actually, it's not. It's neither insoluble nor is it inevitable. And any of these conflicts, even the Middle East, in my view, is not insoluble, but it's not inevitable that we're going to solve it. You have to have leaders who believe they can do it, who have patience, and above all, who can remember what happened last time.
Mm. But as a couple of critics have suggested, it was also, they were starting to bleed from within quite badly, and they were starting to lose their money. This is the IRA. And so they had eventually, they were getting exhausted too. Does that help?
Absolutely. No, what I mean by mutually hurting stalemate, both sides have to realise they're not going to win. And often there's a generational aspect to this. You know, in Northern Ireland, Adams and McGuinness were really quite young when they joined the Republican movement in the late 60s. By the mid 80s, they were well past fighting age and they could see their sons and daughters, nephews and nieces getting arrested, getting killed. They realised they were never going to be defeated as the IRA, but they were never going to be able to drive the Brits out either. And it was when they realised that they started reaching out first to John Hume, the moderate leader of the SDLP, and then to the Irish government, and eventually to the British government. And that's what you see around the world. When people realise they can't win, then they start reaching out, and then you can get to a settlement.
Mm. We're talking to Jonathan Powell, whose new book is called Talking to Terrorists, How to End Armed Conflicts. And you extrapolate from this, do you, that in a sense, and you looked at the history down through the years of your four waves of terrorism, really, and the first the anarchist wave, then the anti-colonialist wave, then the new left wave, and now this wave, which I don't know whether you've actually got a name for. And you passionately believe, do you, that most terrorists can be negotiated with?
Well, what I'm arguing is that if they have real political support, you are going to end up negotiating with them in the end.
If they have political support.
Yeah, so I rule out things like the Symbionese Liberation Army, if you remember that with Patty Hearst in the States, or Baader-Meinhof in Germany, these small fractional groups, usually middle-class kids, who are sort of almost after a good time rather than anything else. That's not sort of a group you need to talk to. But if you're talking about the Tamil Tigers, you're talking about the IRA, you're talking about the FMLN in El Salvador, have real political support. In the end, experience seems to suggest you're going to have to talk to them. Hugh Orde, who was our chief constable of the Northern Ireland Police Service at the time of the Troubles and the transition to a new police service, said there was no evidence of any terrorist movement being policed out anywhere in the world. In the end, if there's a political issue, you're going to have to talk politically. Now, I'm not being ridiculous about this. Obviously, all these conflicts are very, very different, and the solutions you find are very, very different. But what does seem to be true is that you do need to talk to them if you're going to finish in the end. I'm not, by the way, suggesting talking by itself. That would be ridiculous too. You have to have the security pressure down. But if you have the pressure down and no political way out, all they'll do is fight to the death. You need to combine the two. You need to have security pressure down and a way out for them politically. If you have that, you might end the conflict.
Now, what intrigued me in your analysis was your view that even people with exceptionally outrageous demands, or demands that seemed completely, like, say, the establishment of a caliphate, which would undermine a lot of the nation state whole system that we've built up, you know, since the Treaty of Westphalia, more or less, how you say that it's still worth considering trying to negotiate with people who have this view, because by negotiating, you can help, you can encourage them to moderate their demands. Because some critics have said, well, what's the point of negotiating with people who chop people's heads off and who have demands that are utterly unbelievable, like cannot be imagined in the world in which we've created? So how do you answer them?
Well, I think, again, you see a pattern in this. The demand the IRA made of a united Ireland, despite the wishes of the people of Northern Ireland, was completely unacceptable to the British government, completely unacceptable to the people of Northern Ireland. It was never going to be agreed, however long we sat and negotiated. But that's not what we did agree. When you started talking to people from the Republican movement, instead we ended up with power sharing. We ended up with north-south bodies between the north of Ireland and the south. We ended up with the Irish language. And the same is true, again, if you look at Aceh. There was GAM demanding independence, demanding an Islamic State. They settled instead for autonomy within Indonesia. If you look at the Philippines, the MILF, likewise demanding a separate Islamic State. They've settled for autonomy inside the Philippines. So if you start with these groups and you start talking, and it takes a long time, these groups live in sort of a ghetto, both often physical and intellectual. They're only talking to each other. And they need to talk to people from outside to get a better view of the rest of the world and how they will be seen and what's possible. Take the Taliban, for example, in Afghanistan. You know, when I left government, I said we should be talking to the Taliban. I was rubbished by the Foreign Office and said, no, of course we shouldn't. Well, the American government negotiated the release of Bowie Bergdahl with them earlier this year, an American sergeant. So people do negotiate with them in the end. And what I'm saying is, let's remember the lessons from last time, however outlandish this new group we meet is, and see if we can't talk to them. It will take time. You couldn't sit down with ISIS now and negotiate. You wouldn't get anywhere. What you could do is what we did with the IRA. We opened a channel to them in 1972. That channel was what was used for negotiations by John Major in 91 to 93, which led to the ceasefire.
So that's nearly 20 years. Channel.
That's right. It's a long time. Mm. Now, it doesn't have to be that long. In other countries, the same sort of pattern happens, for example, in Colombia, and it can happen more quickly. But it will happen a lot more quickly if we remember what we did last time.
It is interesting, though, how do you deal with people who have such terrible blood on their hands? You have a very interesting little anecdote that when you first met Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness in Belfast in October 1997, you declined to shake their hands and you say, a petty gesture I now regret. And I thought, sitting here thinking, no, I don't think that's a petty gesture at all. I would have thought that was completely within your rights to, in effect, signal to them, I object to your methods. I'm here for a greater purpose, but I object to your methods. So how does one deal with people who have really been murderous and bloodthirsty in a way that you want to register your abhorrence of?
Well, that's right. You do. You have your feelings and you have to deal with your feelings. In my case, they had shot my father and injured him in an ambush in 1940 in Northern Ireland. My brother, who worked for Mrs. Thatcher, had been on their death list for 8 years. when I met them, I didn't feel very warm and cuddly about them. And that's why I refused to shake their hands. And it's interesting, again, I find that story coming back again and again in all of these negotiations in Latin America and Asia. First time they meet, these people don't want to shake hands with these terrorists who've done terrible things to them. And the people on the terrorist side often don't want to meet the people from the army who've been killing their families and locking people up. So you have this.
Do you remember Rabin? I'm just sorry to interrupt. Do you remember that extraordinary shot of Rabin exceptionally reluctantly shaking Arafat's hand?
Absolutely. And he was a really great leader. And he explained afterwards it's the last hand in the world he wanted to shake. He'd have rather shaken the hands for someone from the Netherlands or someone from Switzerland. But he had to shake the hand of his enemy because that was the person he was trying to stop fighting. He didn't have to shake hands with his friends. There's people like him and people like Mandela who understand they've got to bridge that gap, however much they hate it.
Probably got Rabin killed, of course.
It did. He was a brave man and he was killed. And that's one of the things that derailed the Oslo process that offered so much hope. And it's a huge shame. Quite often peacemakers are killed. The first peacemaker in the Middle East, a Swedish count, Count Folke Bernadotte, was also shot trying to make peace back in the 1950s. So I'm afraid that is the fate often of people who are trying to be brave, trying to lead and trying to make peace.
And you do say, just finally, Jonathan, that diplomats are often better to do this than politicians. Why do you think?
I think politicians find it very difficult because, you know, how do you explain to your people you're talking to someone who's been killing civilians, who's been behaving in an outrageous way? You know, John Major went before our British Parliament and he said, "I would never speak to Gerry Adams. It would turn my stomach to do it." At exactly the same time, he was corresponding with Martin McGuinness, the leader of the IRA, by letter, trying to negotiate peace. And thank goodness he was. If he hadn't been, we wouldn't have got to a ceasefire. So politicians find it very hard to do publicly. And sometimes it's better done by people from the secret services, people who can do it behind the scenes. This needs to happen secretly if you're going to start it off. And only in the end can you have the politicians come in when you can do it publicly.
Mm. Of course, the IRA used to give warnings because I lived in London during that time. I don't think ISIS gives warnings. It's a somewhat different scale. But
You have to, I mean, they had a bomb up in Warrington. I don't know if you remember that one where they killed two small children. And I was talking the other day to the father of one of those small children, Colin Parry, and his son, Tim Parry, died in that bomb. And Colin says that Tim, as he was dying in his arms, if he'd known that the British government was negotiating with the IRA, as they were at that very moment, he'd have been horrified. But if someone had told him that 6 months later, he'd have been absolutely delighted because he knew his son hadn't died in vain. There was going to be a peace process. The conflict was going to come to an end.
Yes.
And I thought it was an amazing act of bravery and something that I really feel proud to know someone like that.
Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jonathan, CEO and founder, Jonathan Powell, CEO and founder of the charity Intermediate, and his book is Talking to Terrorists, How to End Armed Conflicts. It's a Bodley Head publication. You're with Saturday Extra and you're with me, Geraldine Doogue. Coming up next, we're off to Perth to find out why engineers say they're not being trained properly.
Seriez-vous tenté par une journée de musique, gastronomie et de joie de vivre?
Oh, if only I'd paid closer attention at school, I'd understand what Christian just said. You can by subscribing to the RN Weekly newsletter. Subscribe now and you're in the running for 20 hours of French language lessons. Or can we seduce you with a double pass to a day of music, food and joie de vivre at So Frenchy, So Chic in the Park? To subscribe, just look for So Frenchy on the RN homepage.
I noticed that a very interesting new book came out called The Making of an Expert Engineer, released by the University of Western Australia. And because I have said many times before, I think engineers will save the world, I picked it up and I'm delighted to welcome the author, Professor James Trevelyan, who's joining us now, who reveals that very little is really known about engineering, even by engineers, that there's a gap, in a sense, between the technology and the very human parts of the profession. He is obsessed with the practice of engineering, describing it and working out how to hand it on to the next generation, this particular knowledge base. He's from UWA's School of Mechanical and Chemical Engineering. He is a mechanical engineer, both choosing engineers of the future and working in the arena right now. So, James Trevelyan, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Many of these engineers told you, whom you interviewed for your book, told you that they hardly ever did, quotes, real engineering. Instead, their lives were filled with random madness.
That's right.
What did they mean? Why was this not engineering, but you think it was?
Well, it's interesting. Many of them actually came to me with a sense of guilt, saying, why are you interviewing me? You know, I hardly ever do any engineering. If you want to find out about engineering, you should talk to other people. But what they really mean, of course, is calculations, design, that sort of stuff. And there's this almost a confession that they do very little of it, and the rest of their lives is filled with administration, what they see as administration, meetings, phone calls, trying to chase people to do things, trying to get things organized. And that's why there's this saying that came from one of my interview subjects, random madness.
Whereas you say engineering is a human performance. Now, try to explain it to us non-engineers, please, what you mean.
Okay. So engineers have ideas about the way things should be built. And we use our engineering science to make predictions that are credible enough to get investors on board to spend the money to make it happen. The real challenge is to be able to deliver on those promises. Now, the catch is that the technical ideas are implemented by other people. You know, you'll often hear it said engineers build bridges, cars, ships. Actually, none of that. The building work is all done by other people, very skilled tradesmen, contractors, technicians. And so the challenge for an engineer is to preserve the technical intent, which gets reinterpreted by these other people who have knowledge of their own. They think this is the way it should be done. It's shown this way on the drawing, but I'm going to interpret the drawing just as you would interpret a piece of music. And if the interpretation runs off the rails, the whole project can become unstuck.
And you say that what you're taught in universities about engineering is engineering science, but it's critically short on this human performance. Is that your essential argument?
But look, it's because this human side of engineering, the collaboration, and it's a very special kind of collaboration, because it's been invisible to engineers as a community, it's also been invisible in education. So we have to, first of all, make it visible.
Because they say, don't you, and even when you try to explain what you're on about and how the importance of describing it and putting words to it, they still say, correct me if I'm wrong, yes, but that's not real engineering.
Exactly. That's it. So, you know, I asked them, well, okay, fine. Could you hire an administration assistant to do all this for you so you could focus on the real engineering? Oh, no, of course not. You need that knowledge to be able to do it. So it is a crucial part of engineering, without which there wouldn't be the results that justify the spending of the money.
Why is this not taught?
That's a very good question. I think it is because of this invisibility. When I graduated as an engineer in the 1960s, nearly all of my peers went to work in public service agencies, where they learned the engineering practice by copying their senior engineers, and they found it incredibly bureaucratic. You know, they had to write specifications, they had to read contracts, and eventually they'd be allowed to lay a footpath. And when it was laid on the wrong side of the street, okay, it was a mistake, but it could be cheap to fix. But these days, young engineers are learning those same lessons, and they make mistakes that cost maybe tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. So what happened in the meantime? Well, governments decided that engineering was not their core business. The private sector could do it better. Of course they could do it better because they chose the best of the engineers out of the public sector. So governments outsourced engineering, but they didn't outsource the training, and the training got forgotten. So we've been through a period of 20 to 30 years when we haven't really trained people in how to deliver reliable results in engineering. And now these last cohorts of people who can do this are retiring. We see, of course, the skills shortage.
Is that what, in your opinion, contributes to our dreadful cost overruns in Australia?
Absolutely. Yes, undoubtedly.
But does that mean, is the corollary of that then, that, say, engineers in China who seem to deliver these, just for an example, these extraordinary, you know, underground networks, well, I don't know whether they're on time and on budget. They're certainly there and they seem to be cheaper than ours, but I suppose you could question that because it's not transparent. But, I mean, how do we compare with, say, very good quality Chinese engineers?
Okay, good question. So I'm relying on industry research here, which looks at projects across all countries, but only where the participants actually sign up to allow full transparency of their operations, obviously in confidence. And that's where the best project performance data comes from, and it's not a pretty picture. Now, it's important to recognize that Australia has seen the lion's share of all the big projects over the last decade or so because of the global financial crisis, because of the minerals boom and so on. So we're not talking about a problem here which is unique to Australia. In the next few years, as more and more big projects get underway in other countries, we'll see the same problem appear there.
Which is this deficit in training, you're saying, manifesting as cost blowouts, etc.
Exactly, yes. The inability to deliver results because the collaboration side of engineering has simply disappeared out of sight in terms of formal knowledge. And that's what the book is intended to address. The idea is to set down the basic principles on which this technical collaboration takes place, learned from all the several hundred engineers that I've interviewed and met through the course of this research. You know, none of those engineers would have been able to write this book because a lot of what they do is done by instinct. And it's only by patiently analyzing the way they describe it over and over again and trying to see patterns in all of this that the random madness takes on a recognizable shape.
But James, isn't that experience? Mightn't a lecturer or say, well, of course, James, you don't know when you go out into a profession these patterns. You have to learn.
Yes, that's true to a certain point. But we don't expect students to learn how to design structural beams by experience. We have theories to guide them so that they can learn far more quickly. And the same applies to practice. We need theories, we need understandings of practice so that students pick this up quickly. What we see today is a pattern where many young people come into engineering and leave disillusioned after a relatively short time. So, for example, even at the peak of the skills shortage in Australia, only about 40% of our engineering graduates were actually involved in engineering per se. Another 20% were involved in management type occupations that could have been related to engineering. But we had another 40% who were just sitting on the sidelines, being farmers, pharmacists sometimes, real estate salesmen. So we've got this incredible waste of talent there.
Well, in fact, you suggest that a lot of the new disciplines in the humanities need to be tapped to prepare engineers for the world they will actually enter. What are you thinking of?
Okay, so let's take one example. When you look at what engineers do, a lot of what they do is teaching, because they have to get other people to understand the intent of what's required. One of the things that characterizes engineering, and I'm sure many other disciplines, is this idea of distributed knowledge. The engineers have analytical, abstract thinking skills. They've got a clear idea of which way to go. The people who implement the ideas have very good practical knowledge, but don't have that wider understanding. So there has to be a meeting of the minds. And the engineers have to shape the perceptions of other people about what is needed. The drawings tell only part of the story. So that teaching is critically important in practice. Now, in education, we've learned an awful lot about how people learn over the last 20 years. Now it's time for those understandings from education, psychology, learning sciences, and neuroscience. We can apply that in engineering and do things much better than we used to do in the past.
In a way, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking of the change that has occurred in a lot of medical training, where they are also trained to turn out a certain degree of basic technical skill, thankfully. But there's a lot of change in the way they discuss ethics, for instance, their interactivity, the way they deal with the patient. Is that the sort of thing that you're calling for in engineering training?
Actually, not yet. And this might sound odd. You know, we have an engineering education system which has become standardized around the world. We will have to
change. Because the laws of physics are universal.
The laws of physics are universal. Thank goodness. But we have to, first of all, change the way that engineers themselves see engineering. Only then can we start thinking about reshaping engineering education. So it's that understanding of engineering as a discipline which needs to shift first. Even the basic definitions. So in the book, I argue for a change in the way we define engineering. And typically, you'll find engineering defined in terms of the application of scientific principles to solve practical problems. And so that shapes the way engineers think of themselves, typically as problem solvers. Well, when you look at what engineers actually do, most of what they do is this collaboration work that doesn't feature in the definitions of engineering. And furthermore, in terms of problem solving, engineers love to think of themselves as problem solvers, but really good engineers know how to avoid problems in the first place. Solving a problem is a last resort because it always introduces uncertainty and some element of risk that you like to try and avoid.
Do you still enjoy your engineering?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And I enjoy it even more because now I can see much more structure to what I have to do. I get less frustrated because I know even though I only spend a small amount of time doing calculations and maybe, you know, some little bit of hands-on experiments, that I can see how the rest operates as a pattern of behavior and human performance, that it is an intrinsic part to what I do. It's not something that has to be endured.
Where are you doing your best work, would you say?
Oh, I'm developing new air conditioning technology, for particularly for developing markets. We've found a way we can reduce the energy required for air conditioning by as much as a factor of 10. And there's about 4 billion people out there who don't get a good night's sleep because it's swelteringly hot at night. And this limits their potential enormously. We'd like to fix that.
Who, for
you, without busting our energy supplies.
Yes. Who are the outstanding engineers you've seen and why? Maybe my final question to you so that you can try to sort of distill what you're saying.
I describe C.Y. O'Connor as a role model in the book.
The great engineer.
Everyone
who brought
him,
the Coolgardie Pipeline too.
Not only the Coolgardie Pipeline, but also Fremantle Harbour, extending the railways. He did an enormous amount of engineering work. He oversaw that in Western Australia at a crucial time. But the Goldfields Water Pipeline, of course, is the project that most people know him for. And now, barring the fact that there was an unexpected rock formation under the site of the dam, which was not picked up by the initial boring, and it took 3 years to get the funding passed by the state parliament, that project, an enormous advance on the state of the art at the time, was delivered on time and on budget. I think because of the dam problem, it overran the budget by a mere 8%. It's hard to find any engineering projects in any way comparable today that are delivered on time and on budget. So C.Y. O'Connor and his team of engineers had skills that we seem to have lost today. We need to regain that knowledge. So the book is an attempt to set out principles which should help us get back to where we used to be.
I should just double check. When you were comparing and contrasting our engineering skills with other countries, how did we emerge?
Okay, we're much the same really, because this lack of knowledge about practice seems to be universal. It's like an aspect of knowledge which was passed on by word of mouth, almost from father to son, but in the workplace, and was never written down. For example, if you try and find a training course on how to write engineering specifications, they'll teach you the grammar, they'll teach you what to put on the front page, but they won't tell you how to conceive of the document. And documents like that are crucially important in delivering technical outcomes.
Mm. You've got a great line. We'll finish here. Two of the main attributes that distinguish expert engineers are their abilities to perceive how technical factors and social interactions shape the landscape of practice, and their skill at influencing people working with them to preserve the technical intent through multiple reinterpretations by other people. My God, that's challenging, isn't it?
It is, yes. And you know, as engineers, the education process produces, I think, very limited ideas about communication and about people in general. So, for example, engineers find it hard to come to terms with the idea that words and even symbols mean different things to different people at different times. You know, other academic disciplines have moved on. We've accommodated to this uncertainty, and we know how to deal with it. But in engineering, we're only just beginning to grasp it. And there's a huge opportunity there awaiting any engineer who takes up this challenge.
Well, James Trevelyan, I'm delighted you've set out on it anyway. I hope a lot of people benefit from these 12 years of research you've put in. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Professor James Trevelyan from the School of Mechanical and Chemical Engineering at the University of Western Australia, the author of The Making of an Expert Engineer. It's published by CRC Press, and he was one of the participants at the Big Engineers Australia Convention in Melbourne during this week, where I think this story forced itself onto the agenda a bit. Good news, too, that in the last couple of weeks, the UWA and Rio Tinto organised and launched a new Girls in Engineering program, which they're going to roll out. So you never know, maybe the girls will make a bit of a difference. Now, time for some of your terrific feedback for just a while before we meet Greg Maloof, who will be coming up shortly, who's chef extraordinaire, getting us very involved in Middle Eastern food. Dr. John Martino got in touch about our story about Murdoch University in Perth and the dramas underway there. Your story on the crisis at Murdoch missed one important point, the chilling climate of anti-intellectualism and censorship of dissent. I noted in your tone and that of the journalist, who was Tim Dodd from the Financial Review, that there was something suspect about the anonymous complaints. Geraldine, if an academic questions management or openly dissents from a university decision or policy, their career is over. Murdoch is part of a larger issue of the supplanting of academics as leaders in the modern Australian university by managers and a business culture.
Universities are now sites of political repression and in no way represent the ideals of democratic education. I'd like you to look closely at what is actually happening to academics, the culling of staff rarely reported on, unlike the car industry sackings, the repression of open debate, and the decline in staff morale caused solely by and through bad management. Now, we got some very interesting pieces on liberalism too, and my interview with Edmund Fawcett last week, who looked at the history of liberalism. I'll just do a couple, and they're so interesting, I think we might try to return to it, actually. Rod Wise commented that Edmund Fawcett highlighted the tension which often exists between liberalism and democracy. This was illustrated perfectly in Australia this year. Attorney General George Brandis, channeling the liberalism of John Stuart Mill, called for reform of the Racial Discrimination Act so as to allow you, me and Andrew Bolt greater freedom to say whatever we want. However, the Australian community, reflecting strong social democratic traditions, said, no, we neither want nor need that right, Senator Brandis. The right of an individual to say what they want can have damaging effects on society as a whole. And that's an edited version of that letter. And this is what Brett Comber had to say. I'd love to hear a similar program on Australian liberalism and how it evolved, particularly in relation to conservatism. I see both ideologies coming together as a bulwark against godless communism. But now that the Cold War is over, both ideologies are expressing their individuality, and conservatism is, without a doubt, coming out on top. Is liberalism in Australia on the decline, and will it be superseded by conservatism, which is happy to take liberal votes but isn't really liberal? Now, the other letter is a little longer, and I'm not going to read it because I'd have to hurry through it, but again, these nuances within attitudes and big approaches is very interesting, and I thank you for your feedback, and I really think we might try to return to a little bit later. But coming up next, we're to meet a man who fundamentally rediscovered the joys of his heritage, his Middle Eastern heritage, and then decided to hand it on. Greg Maloof will be my guest here on Saturday Extra. Well, our travel segment this morning is part travel, part mouth-watering teas. Many of you, I'm sure, will know of the internationally renowned chef Greg Maloof, born in Australia to Lebanese parents. In fact, some of you will have eaten at one of his famous restaurants. Most of his training was done in Europe and then Hong Kong before he opened Momo Restaurant in Melbourne, where he was head chef for more than a decade in the early 2000s. His passion for food, however, started in childhood, receiving treats from his mother and grandmother in the household kitchen in Melbourne suburbia. Today, he travels the world and is the author of 7 cookbooks. They're all beautifully produced with his former wife, Lucy Maloof, showcasing his take on modern Middle Eastern cuisine. This is the big breakthrough, and he's just got a beautiful new book out. It's a pleasure to welcome him to the program today. Hello there.
Oh, thank you very much. Hello from Melbourne.
Yes, indeed. Nice to be back, no doubt. I know
absolutely.
You will be well known to many who've been to your restaurants in Melbourne, and perhaps even in London. I'm particularly interested in your experiences in the Middle East. Could you tell us first about Iran, please, and what you got from there?
Our first visit to Iran was at least six years ago now, and we spent 6 weeks there, and we were researching a book called Saraban, and unbelievable journey. It was, I think, one of the most hospitable places in the world. I mean, I thought Lebanon had hospitality and generosity sewn up, but the Iranians, the Persians, oh man, extraordinary. We were so blessed to eat in a lot of homes. Very warm welcomes, and if it wasn't a cup of tea, it was a full luncheon spread or dinner that we were often invited to. So we were very lucky.
Well, in fact, you say it doesn't really have a restaurant culture as we know it. It is about eating in people's homes.
Correct, yeah. It's especially, look, in the bigger cities there are restaurants, but they do specialise. You go to one restaurant and they'll serve or they'll do one thing and they'll do it very well. Whether it's a couple of rice dishes or even one soup called dizi, which is this amazing soup of chickpeas and vegetables and lamb that's stewed for many, many hours, and they tip this into a little kind of mortar with it and serve it with a pestle, and that's served in front of you, and you smash this soup into a porridge, and you're given bread, and you kind of eat that with the, without utensils, you eat the soup with the bread. So
wow,
it was an extraordinary experience. We did quite a bit of research at the start, and I particularly looked into some classic dishes like pfezenjern, which is a beautiful duck dish cooked with lots of pomegranate and walnuts. And we located these dishes, and I mean, really, it is an interpretation. It's my take, but there's a lot of respect given to the origins of the dish.
Tell us about the rice. You say Iran has the best rice in the world, but it's not exported. And the particular way in which they prepare your rice was a bit of a revelation to you, I think.
Oh, absolutely. The way they get the crust on their rice is such an art form, and you know, I've been attempting it for years. I mean, we have got recipes in the book for it, and they do work, but there was a lot of trial and error in the rice dishes and getting this particular crust to work.
Gosh, if you have trouble, what hope is
well,
there for the rest of us?
I mean, we ironed out a lot of the bugs, and we kind of made it a lot more friendlier, I think, for the novice or even the professional cook to turn out a rice dish like this.
Certainly some breathtaking pictures in your... You devote a whole chapter to it. I mean, you do say... I'm just going to... You say that they prepare their rice thus. They wash, soak, boil, strain, and then steam with a layer of saffron. And you make the point the saffron's remarkable. And yogurt on a very, very slow heat in butter for 40 minutes.
Yeah, it's all...
almost tasted.
It's all there. Yeah, that process is unbelievable. I couldn't believe it at the start, because when you steam the rice, there's only the 3 or 4 tablespoons of water placed in the pot with this pre-boiled rice. And, I mean, all the moisture from the pre-boiled rice gives it enough liquid or moisture to help steam it, and that what gives it its characteristic fluffiness. And each grain you can number or count. It's a superb... And, look, the rice is... amazing. It's as long as a, you know, it's like toenail clippings if you like, want to be so crass, but they're as long, they're quite long, and they're also, it's aged. The rice is aged, which aids in the flavour. And so that's why they don't export, because I guess they just want to keep it to themselves.
Just staying in the Middle East, your newest restaurant venture, I understand, is in the...
Clay Dubai.
Yes, in Dubai, the financial district. Who's your clientele there?
Emiratis and Lebanese are our biggest clientele, or biggest fans at the moment.
The English,
expats, tourists as well. A lot of Australians come in, they're very supportive. But at the moment, there's a lot of Emiratis that come in, which are wonderful. I mean, that's why I'm there. Well, that's why I want to be there, to show that part of the world that Middle Eastern food can be raised above what it normally is.
Well, now, so. I was a little bit confused, because I think you say, I learned a lot from reading the text that you put in, that in fact, meat was often a supplement. Vegetables were the heroes of Middle Eastern dishes. But I thought, in that harsher part of the Middle East, that meat mattered a lot. Am I wrong there?
What matters the most is grains and pulses in this part of the world. A lot of meat's imported, especially in the UAE. Nothing grows there except for camels and dates. So, and, you know, there is the scrawny sheep, and there's a few goats around, but most of it's imported. And I think the fertile lands like Lebanon and Jordan and Syria and Turkey, you know, they do have a much larger food culture consisting of meats. But in the UAE areas and the desert areas, it's more common to see a lot of rice, which again is brought through from the subcontinent, and pulses.
Yes, yeah, see, I really loved all this emphasis on vegetables in this book, New Feast. And you actually wrote about someone who was very close to me. You said that, you know, your experience of a lot of, I think, Australians is that they want to eat more vegetables. They know it matters to their diet. You've crossed this line yourself. You've realised that this is the consistent health message. But they just can't quite get there. And that's me. Now, because I feel that it's learning a whole lot of new recipes, and they'll take a long time to prepare. So are you going to disabuse me of that? Are you going to tell me I'm wrong?
Well, The humble eggplant or aubergine, if you close your... I mean, I could turn that aubergine into a steak if you want. It's quite a meaty vegetable, and if you close your eyes, I can season it up and cook it in such a way that you think it's a piece of Wagyu. So,
but you didn't always think like this, did you?
Well, when we were growing up, you know, we did have a mixed diet of particularly Lebanese. There was a lot of pulses and grains, a lot of salads. And, you know, we'd have that traditional Friday. It was either vegetarian or fish and salads. But often we'd sit down to meals of lentils cooked with rice and caramelized onions and big bowls of fattoush and tabbouleh and tabbal. And, you know, on occasion there wasn't meat on the table. And that was fine. We were happy with that. Stewed tomatoes that were cooked with slow-cooked beans with tomatoes from the garden, all spiced up and served with big bowls of rice and yogurt.
So how have you and why have you made such a conscious decision to cut down your animal protein in your diet?
Well, I'm not sure if you know about my health.
I do now. My history. You can tell people.
Oh, okay. Look, I've actually lost 20 kilo in the last 12 months.
You've had two heart transplants.
Oh, yeah, and that as well.
Oh, that.
That chestnut, yeah. Exactly this time last year, I was in Australia and I was doing a lot of events, and all my good friends, they're all restaurateurs and chefs. So I'd meet them late at night or after they'd finished work, and we'd go out and, you know, we'd eat and have a few drinks, and, you know, it was just the usual thing that I was doing for many, many years, and hence all the weight that was put on. And I'd had enough of this. By the time I left Melbourne, went back to Dubai, and I just looked at myself and thought, no, I can't do this anymore. So I pretty much stopped a lot of things. I stopped drinking, I stopped sugar, I stopped starch, and I got a personal trainer. There's a gym in my building, and I hate gyms, but I was taught how to breathe properly and how to stretch properly, and I kind of wrote my own diet and ate, you know, a nice piece of protein, a nice piece of meat, and made my own salads, and then the weight started to drop, and I felt pretty good.
Do you feel a lot better?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, Clay Dubai, the new restaurant, is a 250-seat restaurant with 38 cooks in the kitchen, so... And I wanted to be really fit and healthy for this project.
You're listening, I'll just tell people who you are. Greg Maloof, chef and restaurateur, who's just opened a new restaurant in Dubai, and who's got this beautiful new book out because he's got such experience of a whole different food culture. Your family originally being from Lebanon with relatives there and really experiencing that food culture, and you've travelled widely, I know, in Turkey, Jordan and Syria. I just wonder what some of the most interesting commonalities in those cultures are for you about food.
The biggest common ground is simple. It's generosity and it's family values. So all the food that's made is put into the middle of the table and you kind of graze through a session of lunch or dinner. And if I had to pick ingredients, you know, the dips are, there's a commonality with the types of dips that are made, the, you know, simple things like allspice or dried mint or saffron, cinnamon, you know, there are those common spices that thread through the whole region. Chickpeas, again, incredibly common. Meats, lamb, chicken are the two vital proteins. Lots of seafood as well. But it does come down to dishes that place in the centre of the table and the sharing concept.
And are people praised for serving very nice food, or is it just taken as a given? You know how we all know the very, very good cooks among our friends and people rave at their food and so on. Does that happen or not, or is it just taken for granted?
Well, I know with the Lebanese in particular, if they're sitting down to a meal, they'll talk about what the next meal's going to be or what they ate the day before or the week before, or that their kibbeh nayyeh or the raw minced lamb dish that was served up in front of them, that their mother's was done in a certain way or their aunts made this biscuit in such a way. And they'd always be discussing and dissecting and breaking down dishes and, you know, often arguing about them, saying, no, this is not right, or where's the mint that's served with the kofta nayyeh, or, you know, it's quite interesting. I've especially in a place like Dubai, they're, you know, super critical. But I'm really enjoying it at the moment because a lot of the customers that do come in, a lot of the Lebanese and the Emiratis are really proud that there's someone in the kitchen that understands the food and wants to raise the level. So,
do they regret the loss of that older culture of food or not?
Well, no, there's enough on the menu to suggest that there is that old culture there.
Mm.
Or there's still, I mean, I still serve wadded arnab or vine leaves, and they're still their mum's, it's mum's recipe. I'm not going to play with that. It just looks a little different in terms of the way it's stacked up. Or, you know, there are dishes, there's fattoush, but fattoush made properly and fattoush made with real purslane and I think the point of difference being that the ingredients are super good. They're beautiful ingredients. They're tomatoes from Sicily. There's all sorts of there's meats. There's seafood from Scotland. Also, there's parsley from Italy. There's in France.
Mm.
You know, mint from Cyprus, and there are some pretty impressive ingredients. And you know, it gets pretty exciting when these ingredients come into the kitchen. You can see the chef's, you know, little twinkle in their eye thinking, wow, this is amazing stuff. And it already puts them in a good mindset to do the best they can with these ingredients.
I should just, in case listeners are saying, why did he have two heart transplants and they don't know? You actually did have an inherited condition, didn't you, which led to a triple heart bypass surgery in 1981, and you were just 21. And
yeah.
Then you went to France to train, and you really had, you know, all the cream and the butter and the cheese caused
havoc.
Oh,
yeah, all that triple cream, yeah.
Yeah, and then, of course, you had your first transplant and your second transplant. So is that something, you just carry that with you, you've just learned to accommodate that? It hasn't robbed you of all your joy of food?
No, not at all. I'm a lot more wary now, and I don't, you know, every now and then I'll go into the pastry section and because I know what cheeses are in the hidden away from me. You know, if I'm going to a restaurant, I won't stop myself from having a slice of this or that that's forbidden. But, you know, I don't need to have 5 kilos of it. And that's what I used to do for many, many years. And hence now the weight loss, and I just kind of want to be around a little bit longer.
Yes, we do too. We want you to be. Look, I'm going to ask you a little favour. I don't normally do this on Saturday Extra, but all of this wonderful vegetarian cooking that you're suggesting we do, would you have one breakfast recipe, given that a lot of people are eating breakfast as they listen to us or about to go out to breakfast? Would you have one you could share with us quickly before we go?
What, off the top of my head or
yes,
in the book?
Yes, off the top. Well, you can do either if you like.
Look, there's a great recipe in the book. It's kind of a granola, but it's got all these wonderful kind of Middle Eastern ingredients in it. The oats have been toasted in a little bit of honey from memory, but there was, you know, things like, well, there were pomegranates in there, but there was also barberries put through it, which I love. I'm not sure if you're familiar with barberries.
I'm not.
They're like a little cranberry with a kind of sweet sour taste. The crunch of this granola is gorgeous, but there's a haunting flavour of cinnamon in there, and the sweet sourness of the barberries, and there's toasted pumpkin seeds, and there's all sorts of goodies in there. We just eat that with lots of yogurt. And
oh, here we are. I've got it. Breakfast, page 23. Middle Eastern granola with pomegranate, sour cherries and pistachios. Is that
it? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've got it, and we'll put that on the website. It does look absolutely delicious.
It is beautiful. Yeah. I love that.
Well, look, Greg, thank you very much. Maybe you've tipped me over into seriously trying hard to absorb more veggies in my diet, which I need to do. Congratulations and thank you very much.
Oh, try the carrot tagine. You might like
all
that.
Right. Try the carrot tagine. I'll have a look for that.
Baby carrots.
Mm. All right, Greg. Thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure. Cheers.
Greg Maloof, chef and author of several books, including his latest, New Feast, Modern Middle Eastern Vegetarian, and it's published by Ha. Is that correct? Yes, I think it is Ha, actually. Now, that's our program for today. Do tune into Sunday Extra tomorrow at 7 a.m. for a special on the Victorian elections, which of course are on today, which I neglected to mention before. 21 political parties are on the ballot paper. I think that's possibly
a measure of our health, of our democracy. I suppose that could be argued, but I think it's pretty something. So don't forget that tomorrow. And By Design coming up after us, Art Deco Radio's Restored and Loved. And may I mention also RN's new white paper, which explores the ideas of leadership. I've written a piece on insights into the women leaders I came across while researching my book, The Climb. And there are other people, including Laurie Oakes, people at the top of their game talking about power and what happens when it is in a deficit. Well, thank you very much to the team, executive producer Jackie May, and to producers Kate Piercy, Mudita Dyers, and Lila Schunner. Do hope you have a wonderful weekend and that we all cope with the various emotions on offer. It's news time, 9 o'clock.
In the Tunisian capital, protesters demand the resignation of the man who has run their country for 24 years.
You have killed your people. Leave immediately.
Since the revolution that toppled a dictatorship and sparked the Arab Spring, the people of Tunisia have held two free and fair elections and are about to elect a new president. The Path to Democracy in Tunisia. That's Rear Vision. Download or stream this program from the RN website.